This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Infrastructure in the U.S. is outdated and will cost billions to improve. Will it be a priority under a new commander-in-chief? Today, Where We Live, we look at one mode of transportation that's been widely discussed in Connecticut and other Northeast states, and that's rail. We'll hear from a Washington Post reporter on the latest to update the rail system from D.C. to Boston. The Federal Railroad Administration has a new plan to do just that, but some Connecticut officials and shoreline residents aren't thrilled. We'll find out why. And what's the latest with that New Haven to Springfield line? We'll talk with a state resident who blogs about transportation. He'll break down the challenges and solutions in the region to make train travel safer, dependable, and dare we say it, faster. Also, what lessons can we learn from Europe? They seem to have a handle on the best ways to encourage mass transit. We'll learn more about the European rail system later in the hour. Now, do you travel by train? What improvements would you like to see? Join the conversation, 860-275-7266. Email where we live at WMPR.org. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Now, joining us now is Lori Aratani. She's a staff writer and transportation reporter at The Washington Post. Lori, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So tell us about the Federal Railroad Administration. There are recommendations released in late December to improve rail in the Northeast Corridor. What's the vision from the FRA standpoint?
I think the vision is more trains, faster trains, and a smoother ride. They've unveiled a $120 billion plan to improve rail connections and rail service on the Northeast Corridor. It's ambitious, and it's their first major update in nearly 40 years. So we're talking about, as I said, more trains, faster trains. It's something that plays well in some areas along that corridor, which is Amtrak's busiest and its most profitable. Mm-hmm. But as you all know, it doesn't necessarily play well in all segments of that corridor, particularly where you are in Connecticut.
That's right. And we're going to hear more about why in just a few moments. But if we could talk about, all of the planning that took us to get here to this point. So was it 4 years in the making, this big FRA recommendation that came out in December?
This was 4 years in the making. This is hundreds of public hearings and public engagement sessions, all to put this all together. Some of the things they're talking about is, this would be a huge boost. Say, for example, right now, you have 38 trains that go between Washington Union Station and Penn Station, New York. If this vision plays out, as they hope it will, that would be you'd now have 136 trains. For you all, a train, you have 19 trains going from Stamford to Providence, that would go to 88. So it is a huge increase. Part of the reason why they want to do this is because they're predicting that the population along that corridor is going to increase by 2040. It's going to increase by 7%. So we're talking about millions more, because you think of the cities that are along this corridor. We're talking about Washington, D.C., Baltimore, Philadelphia, New York, Hartford, or Connecticut and Boston. You'll have to forgive me. I'm not as familiar with the Connecticut map.
That's okay, because under this plan, it looks like Connecticut's kind of the throughway for to get people from D.C. all the way to Boston.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the controversy. So part of this, obviously new trains, faster trains, but realignment of rail along the Connecticut coast. Is that plan realistic?
It doesn't sound like it's realistic. I think both your governor and your senator, Senator Blumenthal, have been very vocal about how this plan is a non-starter. They are not pleased with it. FRA notes that they have made some alterations to help accommodate some concerns raised by communities, particularly I think in Old Lyme. But I think communities still don't like the idea. Some down here in Washington, I think folks who do business in New York love the idea of nearly 100 more trains. But if you're a small community, I don't know that you want the volume to increase by that much.
Mm-hmm. And when we're talking about money, how many billions of dollars are we talking about?
We're talking about $120 billion.
And so the plan has been released. Now it's up to the states and local governments to figure out, what makes sense for their communities?
I think it'll be up to a combination. FRA has laid out this very broad vision. They can't make it happen without money. $120 billion is a lot of money, so I think it's going to take help at the local, state, and federal level. Amtrak is also a player in this, and in many ways, what the FRA unveiled in December sort of fits right in with a plan that Amtrak unveiled back in September. they received a $2.45 billion loan from the federal government. It's the largest in the Department of Transportation's history to help do upgrades along that rail corridor. The bulk of that money will go to buy new Acela trains for their faster Acela service, but they're also talking about adding new stations. If you have folks up there that happen to fly out of Philadelphia, they want to add a new stop at the airport there. Right now, you have to go to the Amtrak station and take another train to get to the airport. But they're talking about a lot of upgrades. You know, one of the things that have always eluded, that Americans, I think, have always dreamed about but has always sort of eluded us is this idea of high-speed rail. I think if you travel anywhere else in this world, particularly in Japan, you see these modern, efficient high-speed rail trains. And in the States, you know, high-speed rail isn't really a thing that's been happening here. And Amtrak, I think, and both FRA believe that with track upgrades, with new trains, we can get we probably won't be high-speed rail, but we can be speedier rail. They're talking about cutting trip times, you know, 30, 45 minutes. You know, that may not seem a lot, but, you know, it's something. It's a start.
So the trip between D.C. and New York would be 35 minutes faster under this plan. Upgrades would allow the trip between New York and Boston to be reduced by 45 minutes. It takes a massive infusion of money, again, to make a lot of these recommendations happen. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Joining us now from Washington is Lori Aretani, staff writer, transportation reporter at The Washington Post. Now, you reported on that big loan the DOT awarded to Amtrak, and that's already been that contract then was awarded from Amtrak to a French company, Alstom, to make these higher speed bullet trains, so to speak?
Yes, it is. They'll be lighter. They'll be capable of traveling faster. Right now, they travel about 135 miles with some upgrades and new trains. They travel probably at 160. They'd be capable of going to speeds as fast as 186. But again, that takes a lot of infrastructure improvements to do that. A lot of trains share tracks on that corridor. It's a very busy corridor, not just because you have passenger rail service, you have commuter rail service, you also have freight rail service that travels up that corridor.
Now let's talk about safety. I mean, you know, as a transportation reporter here in Connecticut, we've been paying a lot of attention to this issue with U.S. Senator Richard Blumenthal with the several tragic train derailments in recent years. 2015, Amtrak train derailed in Philadelphia, killing 8, injuring more than 200. In 2013, a Metro North train derailing in the Bronx, killing 4, injuring many more. You know, what has been the response about making this corridor safer from the federal government?
I think there has been a push for a long time to make this corridor safer. There's something called positive train control, which is essentially an automatic braking system. And it's been something that's been on the National Transportation Safety Board's list of must-do safety fixes for more than 40 years. And in 2008, following a terrible crash in California, there was a big push to install positive train control on trains with the deadline of 2015, the end of 2015. In the middle of that, the railroads don't like it. NTSB says it's life-saving technology, but for the railroads, it's just another expense. I think the estimate is that it's a $14.7 billion fix or enhancement, and railroads have argued against it. They were in the middle of trying to extend the 2015 deadline when this terrible crash happened in Philadelphia. So a compromise came out. They've got an extension for 3 years with a possible extension of 2 years after that. But FRA has been very adamant that this is technology that needs to go in place. One thing I should say is that Amtrak actually has this in place on the Northeast Corridor. You might recall that we recently had a crash in Hoboken where the commuter train crashed into the station. New Jersey Transit did not have positive train control. So I think there is a big push. I think we'll see what will happen, though, with the changeover administration. The Trump folks have talked about how they feel that there are too many regulations and this is an overreach. This is something that the industry has argued as well. We don't know what will happen yet. We'll have to see when Elaine Chao gets in. During her confirmation hearing, she talked about how there were a lot of regulations out there and they really have to rethink about whether they're necessary. Even so, without positive train control, there are other steps that have been taken. One of the things that Amtrak did immediately was they installed inward-facing cameras so that they could see what the engineers were doing. There's a push to have a second person in that engineer's cab to keep a watch. You know, right now, engineers it's not foolproof. You can't fall asleep at the switch. You have a system in which you have to keep indicating that you're awake, and if you don't, an alarm goes off to remind you. But there is a push to put a second person in that cab. New Jersey Transit, immediately after, in the aftermath of their terrible crash, now requires that there be the conductor join the engineer in the cab on approach to the two stations up there. Another thing that Amtrak did was, I know it sounds silly, but sometimes small things, small fixes matter. They've installed more speed limit signs just to remind engineers in certain areas of that corridor what the speed limit should be. There's also, in FRA is also, New Jersey Transit also changed. One of the factors in the Hoboken crash, it appears, is that the engineer may have been suffering from sleep apnea. So this has been a push for the FRA, for a very Federal Railroad Administration, for a very long time, since 2004. But New Jersey Transit has now changed their policy so that not only do their engineers have to be tested, they have to be cleared and treated before they can return to service.
And Lori, before we have to go to break, again, you mentioned Elaine Chao. So this is who Donald Trump has nominated to be his transportation secretary. What do we know about her priorities with rail?
We don't know a whole lot. We know that during her confirmation hearing, she had committed to getting a lot of briefings, it sounds like, and working well with her partners in Congress. But it's not clear what her priorities will be. As you know, the Trump campaign and the Trump administration has talked a lot about a $1 trillion investment in infrastructure. But infrastructure can be a lot of things. I'm sure folks are hoping, depending on what mode of transportation you use, it could be roads, could be trains. So we'll have to see how she feels about rail. She did make a point of mentioning during her hearing that her father and sister and twin nieces did take Amtrak down to D.C. to be part of her hearing. So maybe that's good news for folks who travel along that corridor.
And we've heard that President-elect Donald Trump has a lot of connections in the corporate community. Any connections with the president of Amtrak?
I am not clear on. I know that the new president of Amtrak is indeed well acquainted with members of the transportation committees, and a lot of congressional folks were very pleased and sent out very good signals when he was named. So we'll have to see. But he is someone that comes from business, so Trump may find common ground with him. They may talk a similar language, so that could also be good news. He may also bring, I think folks are hoping, a more business-minded approach to running Amtrak.
And one last thing before we let you go. We know a lot of money to make improvements to a very old infrastructure here in the Northeast Corridor. More of an approach to reach out to private investors to make that happen under this new administration?
Well, I think that has been something that Republicans in Congress have long pushed to privatize this corridor. It is profitable, and businesses and private interests like entities that are profitable, unlike some of Amtrak's routes. So we may see a new push for privatizing some portions of the corridor.
I've been speaking to Lori Aretani. She's staff writer and transportation reporter at The Washington Post. Lori, thanks for your time today.
Great. Thanks for having me.
And we'll link to some of her stories on Twitter at Where We Live. Now, coming up, how likely are new tracks and other improvements in Connecticut? We're going to find out right after the break. And we want you to join the conversation, 860-275-7266. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Trains, they seem like such a romantic way to travel. Kids love them. Adults do, too. Unless the train they're waiting for is running late and crowded, then forget it. It can seem like an antiquated way to travel. But there are plans to improve the railways, but it will cost billions, as we heard from our last guest. So what are the viable options in Connecticut? To help us answer that question, we're joined now by Jim Cameron. He's a transportation columnist, blogger, and founder of the Commuter Action Group. Jim, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Lucy.
So tell us about your perspective on the FRA's latest plan to make trains more reliable and faster. And why is it controversial here in Connecticut?
Well, one of the things that Lori from the Washington Post didn't mention was that there were a number of different alternatives that were considered to try to improve and really build world-class high-speed rail through Connecticut. There were different routes that were considered. One actually was going to go from Penn Station, New York, into Long Island and then into a tunnel through Long Island, under Long Island Sound, and then up through New Haven, up through Hartford, and up through the quiet corner to Boston. The other route, that the one I favored the most and I think makes the most sense, would be to take an inland route, basically following Interstate 84. So you'd come up from New York along 684 through Westchester, hang a right, go through Danbury, Waterbury, Hartford, and then on up to Boston. The advantage of that route was it could be brand new. It could be straight as an arrow, and you could really achieve the kind of world-class, you know, 200, 225 mile-an-hour speeds that we have in Japan and China and Europe. There was a lot of opposition to the inland route from business interests along the coast, the governor, the folks in Stanford, the Fairfield Business Council. They felt they were going to be left out and that they'd be, you know, kind of an economic cul-de-sac, if you will. Well, Amtrak never said they would do that. They said they would continue Acela service along the coast. But the opposition to that inland route forced the FRA to say, okay, you really want to stay along the coast, along the tracks you've got now? We'll do that. And what they came up with was a realignment of some of those tracks, in many cases following the existing right-of-way, but also peeling off in other areas and going along I-95. Now, they're a little ambiguous as to whether they would run the railroad through the median in the middle of the highway or alongside the highway. But the opposition that we heard from folks in Old Lyme, where that realignment would run basically through their historic district, is now being paralleled by communities like Greenwich and Stamford and Darien and Norwalk, where the idea of having a high-speed rail line run along 95 or on top of 95 is not really winning many friends.
And one of those people speaking in opposition is Richard Blumenthal. He's called this plan to realign the tracks along Connecticut's shore dead on arrival. Here he is speaking at a congressional briefing last month.
I am disappointed that this report continues to adhere to a realignment and resetting of routes that essentially imposes environmental costs that are unwarranted, quality of life costs, financial costs, and potentially costs in sacrificing historic landmarks.
I wanted to bring into the conversation now another voice. Matthew Nemerson is in studio with us. He's development administrator for the city of New Haven. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Lucy.
So New Haven, obviously a very important city. A lot of people travel down there to hit the train to go down to New York. What's New Haven's perspective on FRA's latest plans?
Well, we have been following this for many, many years and are very, you know, we actually like a lot of the plans. And, you know, Jim mentioned the plan that went to Long Island and then went under the Sound. We thought that was actually viable, although very expensive. But tunneling has gotten much better and it's happening all around the country. But we actually like the plan a lot right now. And for us, in terms of the commute shed, the ability to get to more jobs, it's a very, very important part of, I think, the future of Connecticut's growth, because being able to go faster and to have more trains between both New Haven and Bridgeport and Stamford getting into New York really opens up millions of jobs. And a lot of this is really about how far you can get in an hour, in 45 minutes on a train. We all know how backed up the highways are. We know how hard it is to create jobs in Connecticut. And so being linked to the New York job market is certainly a critical thing for all of us. You know, we're a little disappointed that the way the senators jumped on some of the obvious environmental things that the report said would be worked out. We knew there were a lot of things that had to come in terms of sort of finalizing all of this. We're part of a big, big system here between Washington and Boston. And as you said earlier in the show, we're just one piece of that. And we don't want to see the money spent simply between Washington and New York, where there obviously is the largest economic gain. But we think that for us, the percentage gain, New York might pick up 10% more jobs in terms of a commute shed. A place like New Haven can go up 10 times. And so for us, this is really a critical issue. And we feel that for the entire state, especially now with the Springfield line being connected to New Haven, that this is really an existential moment for Connecticut to be part of the whole growth between Washington and Boston and New York. And we've seen that Connecticut's been bypassed by a lot of that. We think this rail system can actually make a big difference.
So you were saying that you think it was premature for Richard Blumenthal to say dead on arrival?
Well, we're a little disappointed about that. We talked to his office. We understand the intense intensity against this in places like Old Lyme, and that's certainly the way these kind of environmental things work. 100 people against something are different than 1 million people who are kind of for it. But we think that it's very important that we express that we want to be part of this system between Washington and Boston, and that we've seen companies leave Connecticut, go to Boston. We've seen sort of a realignment of New York as a tech center. We really want to own all of that. We feel that we're so close. We're a lot less congested. Even though there is a lot of congestion in the Fairfield County area, it's still a lot less compared to northern Jersey and the New York area. We think we can be advantaged by both price and by just quality of life here. But you have to have the connections, especially with young people. And I think you have a lot of shows that you talk about different generational issues. Millennials love to travel by train. They don't even mind a crowded train or it being a little bit late compared to having to get a car, compared to having to sit in traffic on I-95. There are so many advantages to trains. High-speed trains, but also, as Jim and Lori pointed out, just the number of trains that are going to be on the system, the new train sets coming in. What a great opportunity for Connecticut to be totally cemented to the Boston and New York areas.
Jim Cameron, what's your take? Again, transportation columnist and blogger, founder of the Commuter Action Group.
Well, there's this dream that I keep hearing from the business community of what they call 30-30-30. You know, having trains that can run from Hartford to New Haven in 30 minutes, from New Haven to Stamford in 30 minutes, and from Stamford to Grand Central in 30 minutes. Well, you know, that's not going to happen. It's not with this existing right-of-way. I mean, a train from New Haven to Grand Central now, it's about 75 miles. It takes about 2 hours. There's no way you're going to get that down to 1 hour. What the FRA is proposing with this coastal route is not true world-class high-speed rail. It's higher speed. I think that the savings with some of the realignment was, what, in the 45-minute range between New York and Boston? Even Metro North is being forced to run at slower speeds now since the derailment in Fairfield and the FRA getting up their backside and looking at all of the safety violations they had. So, yes, it's clear that the extended commute times, even on Metro North, because of the slower running of trains, has impacted the business community. It's impacted real estate values of people who live in those communities. When folks work in New York City, they kind of draw a 60-minute commuting circle. How far out of the city can they get in 60 minutes? And that line does not get you as far as it used to.
Matt Nemerson wants to respond.
Well, one of the big things that I think can happen, and Jim, I think you agree with this, is that we can get more trains into Penn Station, some of the commuter lines. And as the East Side Access opens up Long Island Railroad trains going to Grand Central, there are going to be more platform availabilities in Penn Station. That is a much faster commute when you make that left-hand turn at New Rochelle and bring the trains there. West Side of Manhattan is very powerful. And also, yes, it's true that people are looking for how far can they get from when they're in New York City, but we're looking at how far can you get a job when you're living in New Haven or Bridgeport. Because for us, you know, having the advantages of Yale and having a lot of the high-tech firms in Connecticut, oftentimes a spouse or a partner wants to still have a job in New York or Boston. They may not be commuting every single day, but being able to get there even in an hour and 30 minutes is a huge advantage over 2 hours. So for us, this is a very important way to be more competitive globally.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchel. Today we're talking about rail in Connecticut and if improvements will be happening in the near future in the busy Northeast Corridor. You can join the conversation, 860-275-7266. Before we take a call, I wanted to go back to Jim Cameron. You mentioned that even with some of the improvements with the realignment of track, it wouldn't be true high-speed rail. I wanted to play a bite from a show called Extreme Trains, actually describing the Acela.
Amtrak's Acela Express. A lightning-fast, European-style bullet train linking this country's biggest cities. This bullet train zooms from downtown to downtown up to 150 miles an hour.
So that sounds fast and exciting, Jim, but it's not entirely accurate because of the way the tracks are laid out and because of the population density?
A European-style bullet train. Give me a break. You know, there's like one stretch in western Rhode Island. I've ridden Acela. I've got an app on my phone with a speedometer, and I track how fast that train's going. Yeah, we hit 147 miles an hour in one little section. But along the corridor between, you know, where Metro North runs, Acela runs no faster than Metro North does, maybe 90 miles an hour. Over its entire run between Washington and Boston, when you factor in the station stops, etc., it averages 70 miles an hour. Now, I've been to China. I've ridden trains between Beijing and Shanghai, the distance of New York to Chicago, in 5 hours, 225 miles an hour. Now, the Commissioner of Transportation from the federal government of the U.S. went and took a look at that line and said, you know, it's amazing what you can do in a country where you only need three people to make a decision. We're going to go from here to there, and here's how we're going to build it. And if you're in the way, too bad, no environmental impacts. I mean, China's been able to do it, but, you know, that's not going to happen in this country. If the FRA is wedded to moving along the coast and has no support from our congressional delegation, our State Department of Transportation, or our governor, the idea of running a high-speed rail along I-95 is just not going to happen. I think that they should go back and reconsider that inland route. We would still have good train service to New Haven. We'd still have Acela. We wouldn't have the new 165-mile-an-hour Acela, which is not the speed it's going to run at. That's its capabilities.
And this all comes at the time when Amtrak, we heard, just received a $2.45 billion contract or union, I'm sorry, loan from the Transportation Department. And they've already awarded it to a French company to build more of these high-speed bullet trains, but they won't be able to actually go as fast as they're able.
That's about right. And I think it's to the Obama administration's credit that they got that loan through to Amtrak to not only buy new rail cars, but beef up the stations, add more stations, as Lori mentioned, at important hubs like Philadelphia Airport. So, you know, I think Amtrak's doing a good job. The new president of Amtrak is not just a business person. He came out of retirement having worked at freight railroads. Very smart guy, very popular with the employees. I think he's going to have a good vision. The question is, are we going to be able to tap into President-elect Trump's trillion dollars that he wants to spend on infrastructure and make sure that that doesn't all get sucked into building new highways?
Let's take some calls now. Lynn from West Hartford. Lynn, you're on the show.
Hi, this is Lynn. The thing that really worries me about this whole plan of throwing billions of dollars into the coastline is climate change. We've already seen a lot of devastation from hurricanes like Sandy, and that's expected to get worse in the future as the oceans warm. And, of course, the sea waters will be rising, the sea level will be rising. I'm looking at an article in the Connecticut Mirror that says that in my son's lifetime, a hurricane level 3 could devastate 160 miles of coastline railroad. And that's just, you know, why would we pour billions of dollars into the coast? We should be putting our big money for rail into the interior and just maintain the coast for the people who are using it.
Thank you, Lynn, for your comment. Did you want to respond, Matt?
Yeah, I mean, there are a number of plans to make the coastline rail more resilient, and clearly that's one of the things. Bridgeport's working on it. We're working on it. I think the state is aware of that. I think that's actually one of the ironies here, because I think some of the realignments that we're talking about are for resilience. So these are going to be the difficult things. Clearly, there are, you know, I think going back to what Jim said, China spent $1 trillion and they just sort of wipe out probably 100 new Londons and old Limes every time they sort of put in a new rail line. So we can't do that. But we also have to think about getting to above the water. And I think the caller had a very good point.
I'll take another call. Galena from Waterford. Galena, you're on the show.
Hi, how's it going?
Well, how are you?
Great. I just had a comment. I'm a young person living and working in Connecticut, and I don't intend to stay because there's not quite enough development for me here. So I intend to take my career goals and my passions elsewhere simply because living here is unsustainable and there's not enough development here, and that includes transportation. I come from a position of privilege. I can drive my car to my job, but a lot of people can't do that, and I'm forcing people to leave. And I also understand that marshes and swamps and whatever they have in old Lyme are really unique and special ecosystems and important to our environment. Connecticut is beautiful. But that wealthy white demographic is not thinking about the rest of the people in the state. That's all.
All right, Galena, sorry to hear that you want to leave Connecticut. I'll let Jim Cameron respond to some of your comments.
Well, I'm sorry to hear you're going to leave as well, too. And it's more than marshes and swamps that they're talking about, because the original FRA realignment of the Northeast Corridor was going to run straight through the historic district. Then they came back and they said, well, maybe we can do a tunnel. But, you know, it's getting really expensive to try and bypass those areas. And I think Matthew is correct. Some of the realignment they're talking about, anybody that's taken Amtrak along the coast, I mean, you're right there. You're at the edge of the beach. And Lynn is correct. The water level is rising. Storms are coming. So we've got to do something if we're going to stay along the coast to either raise the track or move it slightly inland, keep it away from the perils of climate change. I mean, you know, if global warming continues, the coastline is going to be closer to the Merritt than it is I-95.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchel. Today we're talking about rail. Jim Cameron joining us from the studios of WSHU, a transportation columnist, blogger, and founder of Commuter Action Group. Also, Matthew Nemerson, development administrator at City of New Haven. You can join the conversation, 860-275-7266. I wanted to shift from the shoreline to the middle of the state, and I wanted to find out about that New Haven to Springfield line. Here's Governor Daniel Malloy on Where We Live last week, giving us a timeline for when this project could be ready.
That will open sometime next year, as early as January, as late as perhaps spring. In part, it might be delayed because we have appropriated more money to double track more of that system, and it might make sense to hold off, even though the bulk of the system will be completed, until we get the final segment that we're double tracking. You know, that was once a four-track system, which was discontinued and then torn up piece by piece by piece. So that system will, in fact, be a brand-new system of tracks from New Haven to Hartford to Springfield and hopefully well beyond.
So we're hearing January 2018, maybe spring 2018, Matt Nemerson?
You know, it's very exciting. You know, once upon a time, 100 years ago, 150 years ago, you could get to almost any place in the state by train. I mean, you could certainly get to Meriden, you could get to Danbury, you could get to Derby by train. Every city was connected. This will be a game changer. Just like people in New Haven want to get to New York, people in Meriden, North Haven, Berlin want to get to Hartford, they want to get to New Haven, they want to get to Stamford by train. And so for the young woman who called in before and said she was leaving, I think there are going to be hundreds and thousands of young people who are going to now be able to live not only in New Haven, but along these lines, get to jobs in a Hartford, in a North Haven, from a New Haven, and vice versa. It's really going to change people's perception of the city, the cities here. And I think if you look at the success of northern New Jersey and other places that have rich, sort of dense commuter rail, people just have a lot more choices. And right now, for people who don't want to have a car, who want to live in an apartment, there aren't that many choices. Fortunately, New Haven is benefiting a great deal from that. We're booming. We're building thousands of apartments, and they're filling in Hartford, too. But I think that for the future of the state, having these kinds of rail connections, and we'd like to see modernization of the Waterbury line as well, because that will open up the entire valley to rail. So we're delighted with what the Malloy administration is doing with trains on the inland portions.
And Jim Cameron, you've been following, obviously you follow transportation closer than most people. You know, we heard Malloy saying this could be ready by 2018. How has this changed from the beginning when the project was first announced?
Well, I mean, I remember this project when it was envisioned by the DOT back in the 90s. I mean, they had a dream for doing this. They just didn't have any money for doing it. And to the governor's credit, and I've never been shy about criticizing the governor, but to his credit, he was able to scoop up money that was part of the shovel-ready Obama administration economic revitalization years ago that was passed up by Florida to put into the New Haven line. I think it's going to make a big difference, not only in terms of getting cars off of I-91, as Matt was talking about, allowing millennials to enjoy transit-oriented development, housing near a train station that they can then use to get to their jobs. But also psychologically, it's going to make a big difference in Hartford at the legislature. The legislature is now going to have its employees and its members be able to take a train to their jobs And psychologically, that's going to make a big difference, because for many years, when I went up to Hartford to testify in favor of transportation initiatives with Metro North, I got this blank stare from people saying, you people on the Gold Coast can go buy your own damn trains. We don't have any train service here. Well, they're going to have it. And I think that's going to make a big psychological difference in the way state government looks at investing in rail.
Quickly, Matt.
Yeah, Jim's right. And also the Boston all the way to upstate New York and all the way to the Midwest line was also part of the dream. And one of the reasons that they put money into this from the Obama administration was to connect the shoreline to the sort of Boston to inland route. And that's also going to change the strength of Springfield in terms of its connections to Boston. And Hartford and Springfield are very linked economically. So for us, getting the whole western Massachusetts and central of the state, the whole Connecticut Valley booming again, these train connections are going to be very, very important for that as we look 10, 20, 30 years down the road.
Just think how many people from New Haven can get up to that new casino in Springfield once line is completed. Oh, maybe I shouldn't talk about that. I wanted to read a tweet. Kevin writes, how fast could a direct line from Hartford to New York City be? The 84 alignment seems far more reasonable. And I wanted to take a quick call, Cheryl from Woodbridge. Cheryl, you're on the show.
Oh, right. Thank you. Yes, I have to apologize because I guess I haven't been following this closely enough to know that there was ever a proposal to go along Route 84. But when I heard it, I just thought it was brilliant. I mean, I actually grew up in Fairfield and I used to commute to New York in my youth, and it was wonderful. And I basically got priced out of Fairfield County as a, you know, professional. And so I'm up in Woodbury now, and thinking about what an amazing boon it would be for the upper part of the state to have something that went through Danbury and through Hartford and to Boston. It seems to me exactly what this state needs, in that, you know, it would connect Hartford, excuse me, to the rest of the civilized world, so to speak. You know, everybody's always talking about how that's getting bypassed and whatever, but it would be a true connection, and you would have an option of using the coastline and or 84. So, you know, when you talk about how great it would be to have something come up through Springfield and Hartford, yeah, that would be fabulous, but not for a large part of the state. It would still leave all the rest of us sort of rail poor. And I just think that's sad, considering when my grandma was growing up in Washington, Connecticut, she could take a train to anywhere, New Milford and New York, you know, wherever she wanted to go. So I think it's something we should never forget about and really think about, like a rail through the center of the state would be fabulous.
Well, thank you, Cheryl, for your call. We just have a couple of minutes. Jim Cameron, obviously, she said something that rings true for many of us that didn't know about this other this plan out there. So what are the next steps now that the FRA has their plan out?
Well, I think that given the opposition that we heard from Senator Blumenthal, who I think has been extremely good on rail issues in his entire service, not only as Attorney General, as U.S. Senator as well, too. I'm not sure if the inland route is still doable or it's going to be back on the table. You got guys like Matthew who are looking out for the interests of New Haven and don't want to be bypassed by, you know, world-class high-speed rail. But think also of what the economies of towns like Danbury and Waterbury and Hartford would mean if you had world-class high-speed rail. The proximity of those communities to New York City and Boston with 225-mile-an-hour trains instead of 100-mile-an-hour trains would make a huge economic difference for the center part of the state.
You know, Jim, we've been looking at this plan for actually 6 or 7 years as it came out of the 2050 plan that preceded it. We've always been supportive of more rail in the state, and so we never thought we were going to be bypassed. I think that's a little bit of an overstatement. But we also liked the Long Island route, which I think you didn't like, because there are 5 million people there, and Connecticut's been talking about a bridge to Long Island for 50, 60 years, and that would open up a whole nother market. So I think that what we should say is let's not be critical of any of the planning that went on here. Both the plans going through Danbury, that was an interesting plan. A lot of environmental issues there, tunneling and huge costs there. And I think the Long Island one as well. So maybe if Trump is really going to be spending $1 trillion, we can look at all three of them, fixing up the shoreline, going through Danbury, and having the tunnel under the Sound. Because that would really put Connecticut right in the crosshairs of all of the economic growth in the Northeast.
And one more call, Vicky from Norwich. Vicky, you're on the show. Quickly, please.
I would like to know why is New Haven and Stamford and Bridgeport is being talked about concerning the rail system, but Norwich and upper part of this way is not being talked about.
All right. Good question, Vicki. Jim, you want to take that one?
Vicki, you need a Matthew. You need a stronger business advocate. There used to be what was called the air line. The New Haven Railroad actually ran a line that kind of cut the corner off the state and bypassed Providence and went through Norwich and the eastern part of Connecticut on its way up to Boston. I think that's mostly rail trails and things like that now. But there are, in regards to that and other areas of the state, there are a lot of disused, unused rights of way where trains used to run that could still be recaptured and put rails down to expand rail service throughout the state. And I think that Norwich needs to be considered. The Groton area, the sub base that's there as well too. New London. New London doesn't get a Sella service. It only gets regular slow train Northeast Corridor service. I think a lot of the opposition from communities like Stonington and Mystic to even the electrification that was done years ago to allow Acela to run to Boston was because those areas don't get train service. They're flyover country. Those communities deserve rail service as much as the southwest corner of the state in Fairfield County.
I'm sorry, we're going to have to leave it there. We're almost out of time, but I want to thank Matthew Nemerson for joining us today. He's Development Administrator for the City of New Haven. Thanks for taking the drive up. Maybe next time you can take the train to our Hartford studios.
Looking forward to it, yep.
I appreciate your time, Matthew. Now, next, we're going to talk about bullet trains. They're fast and a reality in Europe. We'll find out more about high-speed rail abroad right after this break. This is Where We Live.
About trains. I get a sad kind of feeling when I see a passenger train.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalbathanchel. Coming up tomorrow, the inauguration of President-elect Donald Trump. On the next Where We Live, we'll preview the day's events with a team of reporters and political experts. And, of course, we want to hear from you, too. Are you looking forward to a Trump presidency? If not, what's your plan of action? Join the conversation on the next Where We Live. That's tomorrow. Now, today we're talking trains. Jim Cameron is with us today. He's a transportation columnist, blogger, founder of the Commuter Action Group. Joining us by phone now is Ben Adler, staff writer at Grist.org. Ben, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Now, we invited you on because you wrote a story, What America Can Learn from Europe's High-Speed Trains. So tell us, what can we learn?
Well, Europe has a much more advanced high-speed rail system than the United States does, and we're talking now finally about catching up, in part, the California plan being the most notable example. But the thing that is important to understand about Europe is that cities are much more densely concentrated in and around their cores, and that lends itself much more to rail transit. And so, which isn't to say that we shouldn't try to do it here, only that it's important to situate the stations in downtown centers, and that will trigger more development of housing and commercial space and local transit around those stations if where it doesn't already exist necessarily, rather than going out to some sprawling suburb and putting a high-speed rail station there, that won't necessarily work or pay for itself because if people have to drive on either end of their trip, they're not going to take the train.
We know that sprawl is a problem here in the States, but you also wrote about just riding a real high-speed train in Germany between Berlin and Hamburg and how that's radically different than riding the Amtrak Acela. Tell us about that.
Well, it's just a much better value. I mean, it is faster than the Acela, but is priced more like the regional Amtrak, or even cheaper than the regional Amtrak. So it's just an altogether better experience. Also, on time, in a way that if you take the Amtrak, it's usually late. But it's complicated because they have prioritized that. It's not just that Amtrak's poorly managed, though it probably is. It's borrowing tracks from like freight trains, and it gets stuck behind them. And they've made a priority of commuter or a passenger rail in Europe. And so it's something we need to do here too if we want to achieve those kinds of speeds and on time rates. If you take intercity trains in Europe, the difference in the way that it's been developed, you have these dense nodes in cities, and then in between them, I mean, Berlin and Hamburg are the two largest cities in Germany, and they're only 2 hours apart on the high-speed rail, but in between them, you pass through farmland. You never pass through farmland. If you take the Amtrak from Boston to D.C., you never pass through farmland, and that's because of sprawl. Nonetheless, Boston to D.C. is one of the few corridors in the U.S. that is dense enough in the inner cities to get a lot of passengers taking trains, and is one stretch that is ripe for high-speed rail development.
Now, Ben, we have Jim Cameron here with us, who is founder of the Commuter Action Group and a transportation columnist and blogger. Jim, you said you've traveled extensively. What can we learn from Europe that would actually make sense? We do have these sprawling areas.
Well, I think that Ben is absolutely right. The reason that Europe has done so well with high-speed rail is the density of the cities, the proximity of how close they are to each other. Europeans also benefited from a little redecoration that the United States and the Allies did after World War II, which kind of gave them a clean slate when it came to rebuilding their transportation infrastructure. Amtrak owns the tracks between Boston and Washington, with the exception of a big section here in Connecticut that's owned by the state itself. We don't share those tracks with freight railroads. The long distance trains that go across the country do have to ride on freight railroad tracks, and that means they're slower and they're put behind freight, which seems to have a priority over passengers. And I think that the reason that as Ben pointed out, the fares in Germany and European countries tend to be lower than on Amtrak is because the subsidy is higher. There's huge levels of taxation in Europe that Americans would not understand or tolerate. And gasoline over there costs about $5 a gallon, and that money is being used to subsidize mass transit. We do the opposite in this country. We keep gasoline prices low to subsidize use of the highways. I think one of the solutions to the traffic that we have in this state, in Connecticut, along 95, along the Merritt, is to raise gasoline prices and use that money to subsidize mass transit. Those rail lines run right along those highways. And if we could get people out of their cars and onto the trains, there'd be less traffic for those people that actually have to drive.
And now you've done it, Jim. The phones are lighting up with your proposal to raise taxes. But I did want to just bring up this quick point in Ben Adler's story. He writes, successful high-speed rail requires more than just laying tracks between cities and buying fancy new rail cars. That sounds a lot like what the FRA is recommending.
Well, I think the state has got a lot of interest in, the buzzword these days is transit-oriented development. The state wants to, even along the busway between New Britain and Hartford, their vision is that if you build that transportation, communities will develop around some of those stations as well, too. But Ben is correct. I mean, the reason European rail is so successful, like the Northeast Corridor, is it runs from downtown to downtown.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've run out of time. I want to thank Jim Cameron, transportation blogger and founder of Commuter Action Group. He joined us today from the studios of WSHU in Fairfield. Thank you so much, Jim, for your time.
My pleasure, Lucy. Thanks.
Also, thanks to Ben Adler, staff writer at thegrist.org. Thank you, Ben.
Thank you.
And special thanks to Cormac Neely, the biggest rail fan I know. He alerted me to this awesome series on YouTube, Extreme Trains. Just don't believe what they said about Acela. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Thanks for listening.